Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 478. Talking Dead is back.
Wait a minute. Did you just go, let's see, and then launch into the same way you intro every podcast for like 700 episodes?
Don't try to understand the matrix code
that was,
behind my
it
intros.
Was like watching it turn on. It was.
Well, you know why? Because I just had to think about what I want to talk about, you know, like
for me, it was like watching a DOS computer start.
You know, some people get cranky about the intros. I say this is how we keep the podcast free.
Oh yeah. What you doing?
Oh Matt, I'm. Oh no, we
this
were
is
doing
weird.
An intro
this is
for
weird.
Another podcast. It's not you at all, Matt. It was This is a first. Another. It's for a science experiment
that
Kyle's doing.
I'm interviewing him for a school project.
Okay, so I was born in Louisville, Kentucky,
good.
Grew up in Memphis.
Well, it's about
like
famous Memphisonians.
Say on the podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
This science project was brought to you by Sherry's Berries.
Sponsor.
Well, because it's a really intense story. It's a really intense story, yeah.
All our homework assignments are sponsored by things like Sherry's Berries.
Yeah, that's right.
Sherry's Berries. What is Sherry's Berries?
Well, Sherry's Berries, you can order just in time for Valentine's Day these incredible giant berries.
You're telling me I could still order in time for Valentine's Day?
You can still order in time for Valentine's Day, and you get these giant dipped berries in white chocolate, milk chocolate, dark chocolate. They can top them with chocolate chips, the little decorative swizzles.
So what this sounds like to me is a better version of edible arrangements without the bullshit melon.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to look at it that way, I guess that would be one way to look at it.
The melon.
You can get a 40% off discount.
Oh, boy!
By using the offer code NERD when you order.
Okay, but how will they know it's from us?
Well, I don't know. I guess it could be from anybody, really. Yeah. It could be anybody.
Nerd, I mean,
it's
pretty
just pretty generic.
Is it like a 4-character limit on their codes or something? Should we talk to someone?
Let's say there
doesn't
is.
Doesn't matter.
Let's
doesn't
say there
matter.
Is.
The point is, you should get their
Matt's
stuff.
Dissecting this intro the way that you would dissect the berries with your teeth.
Oh, I like what you're saying.
And you'll get all the berry chocolatey goodness
I
out of it.
I am going to go metastasize the rest
the Sherry's berries are actually pretty amazing. And you will appreciate this, Matt. You know what their URL is? Berries.com.
How did they do that?
That's their domain. They got berries.com, berries.com. So you're going to go there. You're going to click the microphone in the top right corner of the homepage and type in nerd.
That's
go to berries.com and type in nerd.
Offer
ends Thursday. Offer ends Thursday,
more
the 13th.
Impressed
of February.
By that than anything.
Isn't that amazing?
Your childlike wonderment on your face is.
Well, sometimes I type in, I go to the Huffington Post, right?
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I type the word hug accidentally. And I expect
the Huffington Post?
I expect it to autofill. HUF, and then it autofills Huffington, and then I hit enter. But sometimes
that
I hit hugs.
I would like to go to the Huffington.
But sometimes
Post
I hit hug and then enter. So it goes to hug.com, which is nothing right now. So
really?
What I'm saying is, guys, let's buy it.
Someone's got to own it.
Someone has to.
Hug.com. I don't know what we could put there.
I'm going to look it up.
All right.
So if it's available now, it won't be by the time this goes up. I'm going to own hug.
Nice.
I'm going to own hug.
And also, if you go to mattmyra.com, you'll see a Google search of pizza cats.
There goes Matt Meyer, everyone. He's out of here. And we're almost out of here, too. Morgan Murphy was the guest. Dear, dear, dear friend of ours. We all started comedy around the same time.
At Bruco.
At the Bruco. Morgan has a new special called Irish Goodbye, which was filmed at Meltdown, at Nerd Melt, at the Nerdist Showroom at Meltdown. It is on Netflix now. Check it out. It's sort of like in the BJ Novak podcast where it's, you know, it's maybe it's lame that we have to sit down for a podcast to catch up, but the important thing is that we do get to catch up. And Morgan's great. So here we go. The Nerds Podcast, number 478 with Morgan Murphy.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome, Morgan Murphy, to the Nerdist Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I was late today, but I got here. Am I not supposed to say that I was late?
No, it's
late?
Fine. You can say whatever you want.
Oh.
It's really fine. It's
I'm not a late person. I'm
no,
not
it's
like
easy
a person
to assume that we would have been at Meltdown, where we do a lot of shows.
I thought you lived there.
Well, now I live here a lot of the time. Oh. I split my time. Actually, I don't get to spend a lot of time at Meltdown anymore because everything I do is here.
True.
So I get to, you know, pop over from time to time. But there's always stuff going on there. I like that. I kind of wish it was 24 hours.
That would be cool.
Yeah, there was a film crew there. Big, busy film crew.
Oh, yeah, for Jonah and Kamail's.
Yeah.
Jonah and Kamail's Comedy Central show. I know. They did a lot of really cool artwork on the, like, they painted the walls with this really cool mural and It looks pretty rad. Like, the place looks great. I should probably get them to leave a lot of that stuff so we can make it look like we're really trying the rest of the year. That's the way to do it. I haven't seen your special yet just because I've not stopped working. My girlfriend's been watching it, and she was like, "Oh, I'm watching Morgan Murphy's special. It's fun and funny." And I go, "It's a little bit of trivia."
Yeah,
I bought Morgan Murphy her first legal beer.
Yeah.
Was it beer or just a drink?
It was a beer, and you and Zach were you guys both bought me drinks like the second I turned 21.
Oh, but Zach Galifianakis. Yeah, we went to Madison's, right? We went to that bar. Were we at the Gypsy or the Bruco or something?
I think we were at the Bruco.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to one of your many.
All of them.
Haunts.
Yes.
And
if they had beer, I would haunt that place.
Yes. And I had my first legal, and yeah, you bought me my first legal drink.
Have I known you since you were like 18 or 18 years
19,
old?
I feel like I started, it was like turning 19. I was 18 turning 19 when
I
started.
That's amazing. I really wish I had gone after comedy when I was 18. I wanted to do it. I did it a little bit. I mean, I did it in college and with a comedy group. But just the idea at 18 of just kind of like going out and doing open mics and trying to tackle it.
Yeah.
It took me 9 more years before I actually got the balls to start doing stand-up.
But you were working. I mean, you were working as a person who presented things and, you know, spoke to
camera. How British of you. I was a presenter.
You spoke eloquently.
Welcome to Single Down, bitches. I was a philosophy major. That's all right.
You were always a high. Yeah, I mean, I feel like the first, gosh, at least like first 3 to 5 years of stand-up, like you were a constant, wonderful presence.
That was a fun group. It's funny that we were just talking to BJ Novak about that the other day too, because you and BJ were kind of in the same class in terms
yeah.
of like that year, you know, like you and BJ and Dan Mintz and
yeah.
then there are a handful of other people, but it really was infused with this kind of new young energy and a new kind of joke style, which people weren't really I don't know how else to say it. It wasn't really in fashion at the moment, like to come in with the two-line joke style.
Right.
And then it really, like, I don't know, it just sort of opened up the doors for this whole new wave of quick joke comedy.
You mean I helped open doors?
You did. You helped
Aww.
Open doors. I mean, it's, you know.
It's so weird to even think of myself as being someone who's not new or young. Like, I'm I still go like, oh, I'm just a young kid out there. Then I show up and I go, I don't know anybody.
Oh, yeah.
What happened to the whole scene?
Even I still feel that way, though, and I'm way older than you, but I still feel that way, especially if I see, you know, like, I don't know, just groupings of comics, like older comics. I go, yeah, I'm the young. And
yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. No, there's a whole, I'm way, way, way past, especially at the show that you did at the Improv that I jumped up on.
Oh, like, right. Ago.
That was really fun.
That was fun.
And it was kind of, on the one hand, it was sort of a reunion, especially the earlier show being, you know, Howard Kramer and Chip Pope and Laura House and Jen McClain and all these people. And then,
yeah.
And then our show. And
I saw Riley Newton hanging out there.
Hanging out there.
It was great.
But then also there were a lot of younger people. I was like, who the fuck are these people? Like, yeah. There was some comic that went up on your show who was like 20 years old.
Oh, yes. A really funny kid whose name escapes me, but I remember talking to him before.
And he was shockingly funny. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. It's just that usually the 19 and 20-year-olds that I've encountered don't, at least with comedy, aren't as confident and don't form ideas that way, well on stage yet, because they're still figuring it out and they're young. But he clearly, like...
I think his name was like Pete Davidson or something, but I could have both names wrong, first and last.
Dave Peterson?
Peter Stevenson, the 20-year-old phenom.
Peter Stevenson. Yep. Peter Stevenson. But he was great, and the whole show, and then the British guy who apparently was super huge comic in England.
Yeah.
Who was really funny, whose name I can't remember now.
His agents, I guess, are mine.
Mine too.
Not really, but they all like left right after his set, and I was like literally like going up like on stage, and I go, I think that's my agent leaving.
I remember you did say that.
Yeah. I go, all right.
That's so funny. Yeah, it is. It is sort of funny when you share agents with someone and they show up and you're like, oh, but and then you think they're there for you.
Yeah.
But then they all act surprised to see you.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, the other guy. There's the other guy here. Oh, his name was Jack Whitehall?
Yeah,
right?
Whitehall. Nice. He seemed very pleasant.
Really pleasant, really funny.
Really funny.
And really, like, plays massive venues. And
yeah.
But are you performing a lot around town? Or are you – because now that the special's out, you're starting over?
Yeah, starting over – I mean, technically, it was starting over from like when I taped it, but I write on Two Broke Girls, it's so hard for me to like work and write at the same time for myself. It just.
You said something really. I loved. You said, "Are you hearing the mic cable?"
No, the mic's.
Oh, good for you!
Oh yeah,
great. Thanks, Katie Levine. Now we don't have to sift through the, is someone eating the microphone tweets. But you said something that was so fucking funny to me on stage where you go, so recently at work, you know, the show I work on, the blonde one and then the dark haired one, you don't really give a shit what their names are or something like that.
I was just like trying to explain to people who haven't seen the show, or you know what, probably why their names, but I was explaining a joke that I couldn't get on the air.
Yeah.
And I was trying to like paint the picture, and I was just like, all right, there's two people.
There's two people on the show. If you don't know the show, it's not going to matter if I tell you who their names are. You don't give a shit who the names are. And then you tell it. What was the joke?
I wanted the brown hair one to say, hey, I want a croissant or something like that. And then the blonde hair, my boss is going to kill me. I love these people. And then, you know, the one with the yellow hair, she says, that Beth Barrett's character goes, oh, it's croissant, the T is silent. And then I wanted Kat Dennings' character to say, well, then you're being a real cun. And we couldn't get it through.
No, of course
the
you can't get that.
I thought
television.
I could try. I thought it was the closest to a cun joke that you could get onto TV.
I don't even think I could get away with that on Comedy Central, much less CBS.
Yeah.
Right? The most family network of the major networks, and there's no way that they. But
no,
that is a
no.
Gorgeous joke.
Thank you. I might start lying and saying like it happened to me in my life and just putting it in my stand-up act.
Isn't that fun? The sort of the,
I mean, I was at this French patisserie and this lady was like, "There's no tea in croissant," so I called her a cun.
I think that's a quicker way to the joke,
right?
And also doesn't require any knowledge of your show and doesn't require any knowledge of like network politics, right, and standards and because it's still a great joke. But I like when the lines sort of get blurred about the acceptable amount of lying on stage.
Yeah.
I love that Louis has opened up the floodgates on that, where he'll tell this really long story and go, and then none of that actually ever happened.
Yeah.
And like, you know, a lot of, so where
my favorite though is, if you ever watch like, if you like, I mean, and you know, I don't have any hatred for anyone in comedy, but I would laugh a little bit at like Mencia's last big special. He just kept going on. And then this guy came up to me and said, "Carlos," and just said what he wanted, just what the setup was of the joke. But it was always like a guy came up to me and said this, and I was like, that guy doesn't exist. Like, I know it doesn't exist.
So how do I get into this joke about this thing? Oh, this guy came up to me.
And he said, set up. So I said punchline.
Now see, I think there's such an opportunity there to make a character out of that guy if you're really aware of what your set is. So that it's like he's just this weird recurring guy in your life that comes up and asks you all these dumb questions over and over again. I think
he's like a weird genius at premises.
They're a good team. They're a good team. But the idea of like, you know, essentially making a cake of truth, but the icing is lies. You know what I mean? Like where it's okay.
Right.
As long as the meat of what you're saying is true, or at least reveals some sort of a truth about people or whatever. But it's like in your case, just for efficiency's sake, you kind of need to lie about the setup a little bit in order to service the joke the best.
No, totally. I always, like the thing I close with in the special that I've been closing with for a while, and now I'm trying not to, and it's very difficult. For a new closer, it's very difficult. Have you found that, I don't know anything else other than this. Like, nothing else is going to work. Nothing else is going to work. That's the works. But the closer I've been doing about some dirty thing I text to a guy is, like, the whole story happened in the joke about, like, I wrote, accidentally wrote, you know, cum in me eyes to some guy who's sexting me. And I had meant to write, like, come in me, yes. And I wrote come in me eyes. And the whole thing happened, except I never hit send. I never sent come in me eyes. But I looked at it, read it, and started laughing out loud. And I was like, oh, my God, what if I – like, so the whole joke is, like, kind of a lie because I never sent the text. But there I wrote is it, a thought true, of it.
Yeah, because it's just – for like, to economize that and have to – you know, if you say all that, then it just like it sucks the comedy right out of it.
Right.
But just getting to the meat of it that way is I think that's totally acceptable. You have to fudge a little bit to make stuff the funniest.
True.
Did you tell a story on stage years ago?
By the way, every time that you start this way, I'm gonna like, it's some story that I wasn't supposed to say in public. Like, I feel like it's gonna be like a horrible revelation.
Your affiliation with the Communist Party. There's something about, I'll tell you what. If this wasn't something you said on stage and something you just said to me as a friend, then we'll totally cut it out.
Okay.
But it had something to do with like you like hooking up with a guy, and I think you were a virgin when I met you.
Yeah.
Not to suggest that you were not after I met you, but the timeline was that when I met you, you were that,
right,
and then. By someone else's conquest, were no longer. So I've known you for that long. So there is sort of a little kid sister element to the way that I sort of feel about you.
Right.
And so you told me this story, or you said this story on stage after you had just kind of started really like hooking up with people. Where you're like this guy. Oh, I think this was on stage. Something about a guy putting his finger in your butt.
Oh my God!
Do you remember that story?
One of my first like jokes that I ever told. That was like a story, but it was about I was in New Orleans over when I was in college. I was not 21 yet. I know all like because I remember going to New Orleans and not being 21. But some guy put his finger in my ass, and I went and told that as a story because it was so unfamiliar to me. I think like the whole joke was like, I don't remember the structure of the joke, but like the punchline or something was like, I was like, oh, your fingers in my ass for me. And he said like, are you sure? And I realized like I wasn't sure. And like, that's how well I know my body or something like that. I can't remember. That was, oh my gosh, that was, that's like over 10 years. That's like a 10-year-old joke. Over 10 years.
We've got all the old classics here on this podcast. That was a fun time.
It really was.
Because I felt like it was a, supportive group, but it was, you know, it was a good, I don't know, it was just a really nice group of people to all kind of learn together and kind of watch everyone sort of go off in all of their different directions. And, you know, some people are still in that scene. Some people went on to write. Other people went on to do comedy. Some people, like, just watching, I mean, to do stand-up, but just watching where everyone kind
people
of...
People got married, had kids.
Maybe got divorced within there? Probably within that time.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like someone would have had to, but I can't think of one right now.
Oh, good. We have a good marriage success rate within the group. You know, seeing Aaron Lee and Jennifer McClain together at your show was pretty insane. Because
we would have made like a good remaining group on like The Walking Dead. We would have made like a good like
died.
Yeah. But just
did you ever make the mistake of going back and assume and I went back to that scene maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, and arrogantly I thought, well, I want to crush this room because this is, I came out of this scene.
Right.
And I, you know, like I'm kind of like, I'm working on the road for real. Like I'm really doing it, you know? And then I went in and just got bombed. And I was like, what happened? Like it was such a moment of like, oh yeah, you know, you still, don't be a douchebag. You still have to try. Did you ever go back and?
I haven't been back in a while. I went back for one of the like anniversary shows.
It's all over now. The Bruco show's done.
Yeah, I haven't been. I didn't go back to the big final thing. I like we tape on Tuesdays, and I remember I kept wanting to. I didn't. Is that bad?
No, it's fine. I wasn't able to go either.
Yeah,
we were all out of town.
Honestly, if it was just like farther from my house, but it was probably the most like defining place as far as I'm trying to think of anywhere other than like. Somewhere like a Largo or something where it's like so exciting when you get in there, like the Bruco is just, you just, I don't know. I saw so many people become comedians there.
Yeah.
Like that was the coolest part.
But what a crazy thing that you got to experience in that most people don't go from essentially being kids.
Right.
While doing comedy and then growing up while doing comedy. Like you had comedy as an outlet through a lot of your growing up. Period.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think of it as growing up period. I felt like I was like, oh, I'm a little grown up. I'm a little grown up who's out here doing whatever. I just felt like I was the difference was I was at college during the day and then would come to tell jokes and try to go, I hope I have relevant things to say to people older than me.
Did you go to LMU?
Yeah.
Yeah, you went to LMU. Did you graduate?
Yeah.
What was your degree?
English.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't do anything spectacular there.
Well, you were performing.
Academically or anything.
Yeah, but you were kind of like, did you think this comedy thing, I'm going to just, is going to make a career out of it? Or was it?
I don't know what I thought. I was definitely in the mindset of like, I like to write. I think I like to write comedy. I really don't know how you do that for TV, but I'm just going to do this and figure out
what you thought it was.
It's everything. It actually is pretty great. I didn't expect to like work. I expected it to take longer to like get work, you know. I didn't expect to work like out of college and all like that sort of stuff was, I think, a combination of luck and other stuff, but I don't know. Yeah, I love doing it. I just I didn't expect to. I expected to kind of do whatever people do in their 20s. That's not working, and then maybe have it hit or something.
Right.
And then got lucky enough to like kind of get work, you know, in school a little bit and right out of school. And I think that was a little bit of like a whirlwind for me, because I'm not sure like I entirely knew like this is what I want to do. It was just sort of there to do.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense at all.
Well,
probably not.
I feel like you're one of the ones who said that when you, where did you grow up?
I grew up like all, I moved around LA, Connecticut, Oregon.
That when you said that you, when you kind of came in and found other comedians, you were like, oh, there's a whole group of people who think the way I do.
Yeah.
And I thought I was weird before.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I always, I was such a, not a weirdo in high school. I just, again, because I went to three high schools and I didn't have a strong sense of like my own identity or what I wanted to do. And then I suddenly met comedians at like 18, 19. And I was like, oh, this is how it's supposed to be. Like when you have conversations with your friends, it's like supposed to be organic and they say something and you laugh and you say something and they laugh. And it was like, it's literally like, you know, speaking like Chinese your whole life, but you grew up around people who speak English, and then you meet another person who speaks Chinese, and you go,
but there's more of you.
I get it.
Can you imagine if you never found that? You would have just felt like, I'm just fucking weird. I do not connect with anybody.
Yeah. 'Cause
if you really do kind of have that comedy brain, you don't acclimate to other social situations very well until you kind of learn how to communicate with those people. I'm like, oh, right. Not everyone is going to say the most offensive thing they can think of in a moment, or they're not going to crack, you know, like just start cracking or riffing on something while everyone else is like, what are you doing?
If you had told me when I was like 21 that there'd be a time in the not too distant future that I would enjoy the company of like non-comedians, I'd be like, no way, man. Like, you know, like I was so like, comedians are where it's at. Like, I don't know why. It was like a little gang. And I thought like, these are, you know, these are my people in a sense. Like, these are the people I can talk. Now it's weird because most of my friends are like not comedians, and I don't have that like riff, that constant riffing, which like,
oh yeah,
you know, I always, that's one of the best parts I think about, like.
But your friends are funny though.
My friends are funny, yeah, but they're not. I was so, I don't know. I think you have to weirdly gravitate. Like you have to graduate from like everyone I know is a comedian to like, you know, being with people in the real world and going like, all right, I don't have to. I can know regular people and not be like, ugh, they're not funny. Like I can know regular people and they can be fine. Like they can be great and they can be some of my best friends. They don't have to be the funniest people in the world.
Right.
I think I used to be a little bit of like a comedy snob.
We all were when we were young, though, because we just get very scared and defensive about our own little, like, this is how it's supposed to be. Like, I've gotten way less comedy snobby, you know, as you start to get older. You're like, yeah, that works for those people, and I do works for these people, and it's fine. Everyone, it's just different. It's not that kind of young, like, you don't understand me, man. I feel like I have a picture. I think I have a picture of the night you turned 21. I feel like we were at a bar and there was a photographer there, like a Bud Light photographer, like taking pictures, like promo pictures, someone took a picture of me and Zach. And so I jokingly was like, oh, you signed this picture. And so he grabbed it. And with a Sharpie, he wrote, dear Chris, and the two of us, it's just two of us, like face to face, like side by side, like, hey. And he wrote, dear Chris, wish you weren't here. Is that Galifianakis? I have that picture somewhere, and I think it's from that night. I feel like it was from that night for some reason. That sticks out to me.
That's my mom's favorite like celebrity to know.
Oh, Zach?
Yeah. I saw Zach on the... She always goes, does he like his box? She got him a wooden box as a thank you gift for... For I had my college graduation party in his backyard.
Oh, right.
And she got a wooden box. And like for 10 years, she's been going, does he like his box? I go, yes, Mom.
He
loved it.
10 years ago.
I saw he was on a billboard, and I said, I got him a box.
You know what's really weird is being in... I was in Las Vegas, and
the same way that they have like the Spider-Mans and the, you know, like the Bane and people like out on the sidewalk and characters that you take pictures with. There's like Zax as his character from The Hangover. There's like bearded dudes with a fake baby Bjorn and the glasses.
So crazy.
Just like they're a fucking Batman.
Right.
But it's Zach.
Yeah.
That's so mind-bendy.
That's weird.
That's so weird to me.
It's really weird. It's, I was trying to think if there was like a, I was going to say if there was like a Boris Hamilton
so guy. So specific. I think we should, it'd be really fun just as a personal prank that would only be funny to like maybe 60 people. Yeah. So we should just go out and dress people up like people from the LA open mic scene. We'll put them at Man's Chinese Theater, you know, just like young Morgan Murphy, this giant explosion of red curly hair and
I just watched some footage recently from like that era.
Yeah.
And cuz I got all my tapes put on whatever digitized, is that what they say?
Yeah. Sure.
And oof. Like, it's real weird to watch old. I feel like I can watch something from yesterday and go like, oh, I got better since then, right? Like, but watching stuff when you're beginning is hard.
Yeah,
I like wonder why anyone stayed in the room.
Well, your style evolved a lot from just doing like two-line jokes,
right,
to this kind of interesting hybrid version of that, but with stories around them too. It's a really specific, you know, like the.
I think all I knew how to do in the beginning was like write a joke, say it, see if it's funny. Write a joke, say it, see if it's funny. Like to me, that was, I wasn't a like performer, so you know what I mean. Like I wasn't like I'm going to get on stage and kind of fill the space with my. With my fun.
That's what BJ Novak said too.
Oh, really?
Because he said he was inspired by Dan Mintz, who was doing comedy when they first knew each other. And he said, well, I wasn't a stand up, so I was just like, well, I'll just try this.
Yeah.
I'll see if these jokes are funny. But it fit really nicely in context with everything else that was going on because you were coming out of this is a little comedy history. You're sort of coming out of a period of like, you know, M-Bar was sort of that post alternative. On cabaret style, right. Of like, hey, these are just loose stories and there's no real point other than this is just shit that happened and it's loose and there's no real jokes, but it's just sort of, you know, like, and then so to then all of a sudden have this infusion of people who are like, oh, we're joke writers and we're going to write jokes,
right.
And there's a turn at the end that you're not gonna, hopefully not gonna see coming, or like a kapow at the end. It was antithetical to the rest of the stuff, you know, and Zach brought that in too,
right.
You know? So it was just when you sort of look at like where comedy, it almost felt like it was a rebellion against all that other stuff. But in the end, I guess it just seems like, no, these people just wanted to write jokes and it had nothing to do with anything else other than that.
Yeah. And I think it's probably also hard. I mean, for me, at least the idea of telling a story at 19 that people would care about my real life just seemed like a daunting task. Like, well, that I would go through my day and go like, there's nothing here that anyone who's not also a sophomore in college is going to appreciate. So
right.
I'm just going to tell these weird little lies that I call jokes and see what happens. But that M-Bar time was pretty, that actually one of the highlights, because I think all the highlights that you have like coming up are so little. It's like, oh, so-and-so said they liked me. And like, that's your, you know, your favorite comedian says they like you, and you know, that's your highlight for the next 3 years. Like, I remember when they were printing business cards, because that was popular for business cards were really popular in comedy for a while, and they had business cards for the comedy death ray at the M Bar, and they were somehow printing up new cards, and me and BJ and Dan were like the last three names on the card. It was like, you know, it was like Sarah.
You made the cut.
Yeah, I made the cut. It was like all these like big, you know, all your favorites, the Louis and the Pattons and the Sarah whatever. And then like at the end, it was like, we made the cut on the card. And I remember being so excited. Like more, I couldn't, at the time, I wouldn't have expressed this excitement because I would have been, you know, not cool. But
horribly uncool to
horribly
express
uncool.
Excitement and enthusiasm about a thing.
But that was, I remember being really thrilled about that.
Yeah, because it's very hard with what we do to quantify your progress.
Right.
It's like trying to discern whether or not you've grown an inch in the past year. Like, you just can't. You just don't know. So you need these kind of outside markers to tell you, oh, yeah, I guess I'm doing something right because I made that card, or I got booked on that show, or that's not a bringer show. That's an actual book show, and they asked me to do it, or I got
paid. It's a coffee shop, but you get a free coffee, like sort of stuff like that. You don't have to buy a coffee to get on. They give you a coffee if you go on.
Totally different story.
How exciting.
Yeah, you don't have to bring people, but people will show up that you don't know to see you.
Yeah, I think I remember like seeing, it was like, I can't remember, it was like Patton or Posehn or somebody in the back of Lulu's Beehive and going like, well, this place is legit, like legit as fuck. Like, I was so excited because, well, people that you loved were in the room. You were like, oh my God.
That's how comedians judge the quality of a room, because there's no other way to know how good a room is. So if someone asks you to do a show, any comedian, most of the time, their first question will be, who else is on the show?
Right.
Because you're trying to gauge, like, you know, are these comics that I like? Are these comics that I respect? Are these comics that, you know, that are fucking, like, don't just do any show? Is this special in some way? We have to guess. So these are just these kind of external markers that's the only roadmap we have. It's kind of a weird path. I mean, like, the fact that we have to find ways to be encouraged to keep doing something, you know, I feel like in a lot of ways, comics are like the little sea turtles that are just trying to get to the water. And you know that like 70% of them are going to get swooped up by seagulls, but 30% are going to get through, you know, and some of them will get to be giant sea tortoises once they get into the water. So it's been fun to watch all of us become sea turtles.
Thank you.
Isn't that nice?
A beautiful story.
It's a really nice story. Not for the 70% that were killed. I feel like I remember when you met Lorraine Newman, and you're like, oh my God, I met Lorraine Newman, and you know.
That was pretty cool. There have been a lot of.
She was at the show the other night.
Yeah. I saw her at the Improv. She's, she's amazing. I have, by the way, a tendency to like apologize for things I say before I say them.
Sure, yeah, no, that's okay.
Okay, I apologize.
that was after that time.
Yeah, it was after. But I think that the interesting thing about, I guess, like my motivation was always very kind of selfishly or whatever. Like, I always wanted the people that I really liked to respect me. Mm-hmm. Like, people I was saying, like Sarah and Pat and Louie and, you know, Gapka, whoever it was, like the people that I kind of came up watching, you know, I remember thinking she said she likes me. That's amazing. Like once you kind of run out of peers, not that I've like gone through them, but once once that stuff stops being a motivating factor, it's like you have to find the new motivating factor. And it's like I've never been somebody who got that huge rush off the audience the way some people seem to like, because people are like, oh, I just need the audience and I need the sound of whatever. Like I've never been that person. So it was very like, I was like even a few years ago, it was like turning the page into like to a new chapter of who am I doing this for now?
Right.
Basically like, I'm not a 21-year-old like really trying to impress my peers. Like that's gotten old.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's like I have to kind of just do it for me. And then where's the motivation? I don't know if you like ever found yourself in that place where you go like, oh, I don't know why I'm doing this anymore, and I have to find a new thing to push me.
I like forming a relationship with the audience. I really do like that.
Yeah.
And I really like the process of figuring out. I mean, it's the closest thing that we have to science.
Yeah.
Where it's very much like a scientific method where we form a hypothesis about an idea and then we test it and we check the results and then we go back and adjust. And, you know, like, so I do like the process of finding what works with an audience, because that rush of like, oh my God, I just discovered a bit. And then figuring out all the different ways that you can build around it. And then it's a thing. And then it's a chunk. And then maybe it's your act. And, you know, like, I love that discovery process. Almost, as much, if not more, than just going on stage and going like, I know these five jokes, these five stories I'm going to tell are going to kill because they're time tested.
Right.
And it's, you know, like a lot of times it does feel good to sort of jerk your brain off that way. But I also really do love the discovery process in between. And I mean this as a compliment. I can tell when you're on stage that you don't give a shit about what the audience is doing, not in a negative way, but it just feels...
Yeah, by the way, in my head, I was like, God, does that sound cunty? And
no,
I didn't
doesn't
mean
sound cunty.
That. Like, I don't mean that I don't care about the audience as people at
the
all.
The opposite of that. No, it's just you're not... Your motivation is not whether or not they're going to fall out of their chair with
right.
every syllable, which means that you don't come off needy or desperate, and it makes you a good leader. Because it's sort of like, well, you can be on board with this or not. I'm going to say these things.
Right.
And I think it makes you make more daring choices because you don't, you know, I have found a lot of times that I, you know, if I only have 10 minutes, I might make less risky choices because I don't have the runway to really get into the story. So it's like, well,
right.
this is really just about laughs per minute and not me trying to build a whole thing. When I probably should be experimenting with stuff more. So the opposite side of that is that, you know, for the first several years of my comedy, it was like, there's no spaces, there's no air, because
yeah.
I have to just keep talking all the time to keep the audience distracted.
So it's so weird, like, how talking about comedy can... I don't know. I could talk about it for hours and like try to figure out why things work and why things don't work. And like that moment you're talking about like figuring out a bit, like there's still nothing better than that. There's still nothing better than like writing a new joke, which is so, I think that's, I don't know how you become a person where the best feeling ever is writing a new joke. Like that's like my parents and my aunts and uncles and stuff. And like people I've lived with, they're like, everyone kind of goes like, where, I'm not like any of them, you know? And I'm just like, I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's like, but the heart of it is like, that's what excites me is,
yeah,
is a new joke.
That's
so,
why when people say like, when you meet other performers and they go, oh man, I can never do stand-up. I don't know how you do that. That is so brave to do that. And I always go like, well, I appreciate that you're trying to compliment me, but I would think that most comics would tell you that it's not a choice. That
yeah.
there's some sort of a weird thing that motivates us to get up on stage in front of strangers and say things and have them go, aha, you know, like it's a strange thing. And
yeah.
I don't feel like, I mean, at some point we choose to start doing it, but I really don't feel like it's as conscious as that. It's just like, just the same way, you know, an animal knows that it's, you know, how does a certain squirrel know it's supposed to dig underground to protect itself? Like, it's just this kind of innate thing where you go, oh, I feel like I'm supposed to
yeah.
do this.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, there's no part of my life that would have pointed me towards like stand. It wasn't like I had a performer parent or anything. You know, I didn't have, there's nothing in my life that said, oh, this seems like a logical destination for you, like stand up comedy on a stage. Like, and also, like, I could never do like sketch or, like, you know, I don't do characters.
I
don't
sketch.
Do voices. I don't do like, sometimes I'm like, why do I get on stage? Like, I get on a stage. Like, I don't. I'm not a big presence or a big person. I'm not loud. I'm not. I don't move around a lot. You know, it's just. I don't know. It's just.
With sketch, I always want to go. Like, once a sketch doesn't work, isn't working in a moment. I don't like that I don't have the ability to go, all right, I know this is dumb
yeah.
and we're not who we say we are. And we're like, I
yeah.
just have such a need to be myself.
Yeah.
I really am not. I really don't. Whereas I think a lot of sketch people, they need to be in character.
Right.
Because that is a layer of protection. You know, it's like they're in character. So it's not, it really isn't them.
Yeah. I mean, I always thought, my whole like sketch versus or why I, my whole reasoning, and I think I've like told this story somewhere, but I don't think, maybe I haven't, but why stand up I think is easier than other stuff is that you're only letting yourself down if you mess up. Like in my head, you're like, oh well, in a play or in TV or something like that, if you're in an ensemble and you mess up, you make everyone around you look bad. And I go, like, in stand up, if you mess up, you just fail yourself. And to me, failing myself is way easier than failing other people.
Sure.
So like that, it was a lot like improv and all that stuff to me just felt very, it felt impossible because I would never want to feel responsible for all these other people's,
and the flip side of that is that you don't have to rely on other people to do your thing. That you could just go like, you know, in theory, you could just walk outside and start talking and people would crowd around you and you're like, you have a show. It's not like, oh, I got to call this guy and we got to do a rehearsal and I got to, you know, oh, he didn't show up. So we didn't get to do the, you know.
On the other hand, it can be cripplingly lonely.
Yes. Well, on the road it can. Yeah. I mean, so much of being able to take Chloe with me places on the road a lot the last couple of years has been, it was so nice because it's, you know, at least it felt like, oh, okay, good. This isn't, I'm not going back to my room and then calling my girlfriend and being like, oh, can we just stay on the phone till we fall asleep? <You know? laughs> I mean, it's nice.
I would much rather, I would much rather go on the, mostly because I feel lucky enough to make a living writing comedy for other people. Like I would rather go on the road and open for, you know, feature for a friend and be with a friend than headline by myself, which, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say that that's 100% of the time, but just for, you know, your basic, like a lot of the gigs that I'll end up taking during the year, because I have to pick very few because of my job, I'll pick like the little festivals, you know, like, you know, Portland, Seattle and music festivals and things like that. Cause it gives me an opportunity to see other comedians. And, you know, I'm like, if I'm going to take off this weekend and work Monday to Friday and then work all weekend and then work again, I don't know if I want to like go be by myself somewhere.
Right. Isn't it, and there's a bunch of good ones coming up too. There's a Bridgetown and Moon Towers coming up. Sketchfest is this week.
Right, there's a bunch of stuff. That's also sad. Like the sad thing too is when you're working on other things, having to say no to what you know would be a fun time.
Yeah.
And a good comedy opportunity.
I was just thinking about what you said about having the other comics in the room, you know, like having the comics that you look up to in the room and just kind of wanting to be accepted by them and thinking about how funny it is that you could be crushing in a room of like 500 people. And for the back of the room, you saw, you know, someone like Louis or someone just like leave the room during your set, you'd be devastated.
I'd die.
You'd die.
I would die.
It wouldn't
even
matter if people were like ready to carry you out on their shoulders after a set. If you saw that happen, you'd be like, I failed.
Yeah.
Well, I failed. Even
I think,
though,
like, Louis said to me one time after, like, a Largo set, and that, you know, he's probably my favorite comedian and has been since I was, you know, at 17, 18. Like, he said to me something like a compliment, and then stop bringing notes on stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was like, couldn't handle it. Like, I just couldn't handle, like, you go right to, like, he hates me, and I can't. Why do I have notes on stage? I got to explain to him that I can't memorize things good. But also, you know, I guess he cared enough to say something.
Well, but he's a comedy analyst.
Yeah.
Because I remember I did a bit somewhere and the bit was something about, it was like one of those Dream Machine alarm clocks that had the different sound effects that would put you to sleep. And I think mine was like, there were a few, I picked some wacky ones, you know, like Keanu Reeves sound, and then Tom Likas. And it was just like, like I just made all these dumb noises. And then I did it again because in my head, I was like, oh, well, if the alarm goes off, you're going to hit the snooze button and it's going to come on again, you know, a few minutes later. And I got off stage and he was like, oh, it's a good set, but why did you do that part? Why did you do that one twice? Why did you do that voice twice? And I tried to explain it to him and I couldn't explain it well. And so I got really flustered. But, you know, he didn't stand to gain anything by asking me that question.
Right.
He just really wanted to know, like, from a purely stand-up comedian comedy standpoint, why, you know, what was your motivation behind doing that? And I got so like, I just couldn't answer the question properly.
He's like a rare example, but he's a very good example of somebody who, like, you go, all of his success, you're like, of course it's deserved. Like 15 years ago, I was like, this is my favorite comedian.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that, you know, 15 years from then, he's like everybody's favorite comedian.
Yeah.
Like it's nice to see somebody who you thought was great already get better and enter that, like, you know, I mean, how many people are in his echelon? Like,
no, not many. I mean, he's really at the top right now.
Right.
He's the top. He's kind of the top of the pile right now. But it, you know, it, and even he sort of recognizes, like, well, it's a dynamic system, and I'm it now, but who knows what the fuck's gonna happen later. I always liked, I did some shows with him in Irvine, I feel like, years ago, so we would drive back and forth, and, you know, and then hearing the comedy advice that he got from Chris Rock from working on the Chris Rock show, where he's like, you know, don't listen to music on the way to a gig. You should be focusing on your set and going over your jokes. And you're like, oh my God, okay. You know, I never followed any of that advice because I just, my brain doesn't work that way. But I liked getting the, I mean, it was really cool to hear, like, this was passed down to him and then he was passing it down. And, you know, he's, one of the other comics said something about,
we're like passing things down from people who are like 4 years older than us.
That's how quickly that's comedy evolved. I know.
Louis C.K. goes, this is how Chris Rock told me to do it.
I know. It's not like there's some ancient text from like a court jester who had put it on a scroll and like, this text says, do not be entertained on the way to the castle. But it, you know, just sort of watching someone, and it really shows you that comedy really is, even though it's expressed in an artistic way, it's really like most other jobs where you have to work at it, and there's a series, you know, and you have to be consistent, and you have to approach it very kind of pragmatically, even though you sort of feel like, oh, it's just this weird freeform philosophical thing. Like, it's, that's the illusion of it. That's the magic.
Yes.
That's the magic of it. But it's actually very structured, and it's just sort of decorated to be this, like, yeah, I was just having this thought off the top of my head. Have you ever gone, have you ever gone on stage and be like, I'm not going to write anything. I'm just going to go up on stage and just fucking see what happens.
I've tried. It doesn't work for me. I don't have any. My stories, when they're not planned out, are fairly meandering with no end. Like, they're just not. I'm not good at that. I'm not a. I don't think I'm like funny, haha, as a regular lady. You know what I mean?
You don't think so?
I mean, I'm just not a. I don't hold court the way some comedians can hold court.
Right.
You know, like, there are people, like a Todd Glass or something, who like will be as entertaining at a party, you know, as he might be on stage or something.
He will,
like,
seize control of any room that he goes in in the best way possible.
Yeah, I've never been that person. I feel like those are the people who do well just freewheeling on stage. But I don't know. I mean, I also go, like, why would I go up and say nothing when I like took the time to write down these jokes?
I've tried. I feel like I'm pretty good at crowd work, and I still can't just go up with nothing.
Yeah.
I've pulled it off a couple times, but the majority of the time, if I'm just like, I'm just going to see what happens, what always happens is like, well, that didn't go well.
I think I've done that a couple times, like stoned, and I don't smoke pop before I go on stage, and there's just been a few times where I just go, like, I'm like, fuck it, it's a fun night, we're all hanging out, it's like my third show at the festival, like, I'll just do it. And I get, like, every time it's just a massive failure.
Was she stoned? Yes is the answer.
Well, last time I was stoned on stage, I ran on stage going, I apologize, I just want to let everyone know that I mistimed my pot smoking. I thought there were two other people before me. We're all going to get through this. Like, I kind of walked the audience through my, because I was sitting upstairs. Like, they're like, okay, we got two more people to go. I'm in a good place. I should come down a little bit. And then I heard my name. I freaked out. I ran downstairs. Talked to
people. It's almost like a mini nightmare. I'm not ready to go on stage. You got to get out there. But I'm really stoned. I don't know. You don't understand. I needed 20 minutes to glide out of this. Please, can someone just do longer? No. Did you spend the whole set talking about that?
I talked, you know, and I ended up talking more about about like things that had happened that night. Like I ended up kind of doing what I said I didn't do, which is a little more of like a free form kind of thing inserted with jokes. But yeah, I was downtown LA, and I just started talking about downtown LA, and I was even as I went into it, I was like, downtown LA, you know, you start a thing, you go, downtown LA is crazy. In your head, you go, I don't have any downtown LA material. Why am I starting to talk about downtown LA?
Which show was it? Was that at the Independent?
It was I think it was like a bar near there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't even know what's going on in the LA comedy scene right now.
It was a great festival, that Riot LA.
Oh, I know that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. I mean, I thought that was fun.
I feel like it's funny that I might, in my head, I might go, yeah, I don't know if there's much of an LA comedy scene. I'm like, no, there's a lot of one. You just don't go into it anymore because...
So, like, I know the Chinese food place in Los Feliz.
Oh, right.
And I only know it because it's 2 blocks from my apartment.
Right,
and I can walk to it.
And it really, it's actually a really, there's a fantastic, there could be a very fantastic scene, but just the thought of, I'm going to go park and then I'm going to go wait. And it's like, just to do it's like 8-7 minutes.
Like Neil Brennan does a great show, but it's Sunday nights in Santa Monica. I don't know if you need to get to.
So far, I got to get up the next morning. It's so easy to get sort of spoiled by doing an hour or going on the road or, you know.
I do think it's a harder thing to do when you're comfortable in life anyways. I think like, I wish I could write or be as, I was never prolific, but be as consistently creating new material the way I was 10 years ago. Like, I don't know if I'll ever hit that again. Like, when you're starting, you're writing everything down and everything's a possible new bit and, you know, you're just in it. And then I think, I don't know, I think the comfort of the rest of my life at times probably has a negative effect on how much new material I churn out.
Yeah, but you know that something will probably happen at some point where you'll end up writing, you know, like if you really want that, you can experience that. You
sure.
can just take a trip and go experience something and then express it, you know, like it. But yeah, in the beginning, there's a lot of writing because it's everything that you're dealing with in your life up to that point that you've never...
Yeah.
It's just like...
That's why it takes people like 10 years to come up with their first hour, and then they write another hour every year or two after that. Like, it's like, you know, it's... You get to put so much into that first hour, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I think that tends to be why people's... I don't know. In my opinion, like, a lot of people's first hours are like a little better than their second. Like, I don't know. Like, not doesn't count for everybody, but... You go, oh, yeah, that was like 10 years of material that person took to make that.
Yeah.
And then they made another hour a year later.
Yeah, I mean, it's... mine was 2 years ago, and I'm still, you know, because I just don't have time to be on the road every weekend right now. So it's going to be a little while before I can really get out again and like make it happen again. But I also think your first one is so precious.
Yes.
It's like, it's so precious. It's your first one. It's gotta be amazing. You know, it's just like losing. It's like the first time you have sex versus like the second or 10th time where it's like, all right, let's just do this. I know what this is. I know what this is. Let's put it in. Let's do it.
I think by the time I put the one out that I did it at Nerdmelt, like I think I just, I had recorded a CD in 06 that I listened to, hated, never put out. Then I thought about, oh, I'm going to do this special. I'm going to record it in Atlanta like a couple years ago. Like that didn't work out. Like I kept, by the time I did, I was just like, I just want to make it with like 3 people and just put it online and see what happens. Like basically it was the gist of it.
Yeah.
I didn't romanticize that much as I was like, I have to get this material out there or I'll keep doing it.
It's pretty exciting for me to have a space where you did your hour like that. I got so excited to, you know, when you wanted to do that there.
It was really fun. It was very, I don't know, like I in my head, I get a little nervous that someone's going to like find it on Netflix and be like, oh, what's this? There's like 50 people there. But at the same time, that's what I wanted. And I'd like to think that the jokes sort of speak for themselves and you can ignore the fact that there's like, you can see like the ribbons tied to like a pole or something. You know, like I don't know. I thought that was exactly the environment that I wanted to make something in, because I could just have like Clint and Charlie, the two guys who, you know, produced it, and Bobcat. Like, it was just the three of us really, and then a crew, but I didn't have to deal with some outside production company. I didn't have to deal with people whose ideas didn't align with mine, or like, do it at a theater, or do it here. Like, no, I was like, I'm making a little thing, making it with my friends. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
And that was it. And it's like, it's intimate.
Well, the next special you can do the leather jumpsuit at Carnegie Hall. 10 cameras. Just totally go the other way. Fucking pyrotech, you know.
Electric guitar.
Yeah, electric guitar. Fucking close with a musical number. The guitar comes out of the ceiling. you know, it could be really, you could be super energetic and, you know.
It could be. It could be.
What do you want? Like, what do you want? What is it that you want to happen? Like, what do you, I mean, you're writing on the show. Do you want to develop your own show? Do you want to release, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ultimate.
You want to be on it? Or do you just like writing?
I would love to create a show. I mean, I probably for somebody else. I mean, I would do my own thing, but I would rather someone say, like, if I could do whatever I wanted, it might not be my own thing, but mm-hmm. I would, I don't know. I just, in a perfect world, I'd write something and someone would make it and I'd get to keep doing stand up.
Yeah.
And, that's it really. I mean, it's not that crazy.
Would you want to release a special every few years, or do you want to tour?
I would like to release a special as often as I have the material, but not feel the pressure to have to do it every year. I don't know if I like writing, and I like I really like seeing other people say the things I write. Like, I really like that part of writing for other people, and I think that would probably. I don't know. I just don't know if I would have time to tour regularly and also do the work that I want to do here. Yep. But I would like to be out more for sure.
I think it could be kind of interesting to approach joke writing, especially with the show that you're on, of like the way that you write comedy is trying to come up with jokes that you know would never clear yeah. on the show that you're working on, because it's a network show.
The weird thing is that we get a lot on. I mean, it's, you know, it's surprising to me. Sometimes there's stuff we get on where I'm like, oh, they're letting us do that. Like I don't know. It's always a surprise to see what they come in and say you can't do.
You were at Kimmel first, right? Was that your
Crank Anchors and Kimmel. Really, in college, I was on a pilot. I worked on a pilot that Scott Aukerman and BJ Porter produced that me and Dan and BJ and I think Jonah worked on it. Like, it was a little pilot that didn't get picked up.
Oh, my God, all four of you.
Yeah. And then I did Crank Anchors and then Kimmel, and then took a little, like, break where I did some pilots, like, you know, acting pilots and then I did Fallon, and then I came out back out here.
Oh, that's
did,
right. You were on Jimmy's show for a while.
Yeah. The first two years.
I mean, there's so many tectonic shifts in late night right now.
Yeah.
Like, more than at any other time, it feels like.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, I'm really happy for Fallon and Kimmel. Like, I think Kimmel's really, you know, when I was there, I don't know if, like, it's so nice to see that show become a big popular presence in late night. And then, I don't know, I've not had any bad experiences, like, with either of those guys. So it's hard to, not that you asked me, like, who I'm rooting for.
No, but I think the sort of the post-traditional late night mentality is over.
Yes.
Where they're all... not, I mean, if they're neurotic, they hide it well, you know, like they seem cool. Like, everyone's, Ferguson's cool, Jimmy's
yeah.
cool, Seth's cool, Kimmel's cool, Pete's awesome, Conan's great. Like,
yeah.
they're just fucking cool. They're all, it's like, you know, that idea of, you know, when you watch, like when I watch Letterman and I go, I bet he hates that person that he's talking to. Like, I don't feel that way, you know.
It seems like everyone likes each other too, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel hyper competitive. I mean, I suppose it is competitive because what isn't, but it seems like, you know, Conan and Kimmel and Fallon and, you know, that wave, like they seem to be good with each other. No,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was just there was just a different system in place before where there were like three networks, really, then four.
Yeah.
Cable wasn't really at that time a viable source for real quality entertainment yet. And so it was just super competitive. I mean, they were, you know, no one really understood the idea of, you know, like niche audiences yet. It was like, well, it's all or nothing.
Right.
I either get all 30 million of these people or fuck it.
Right.
And so I think it was just the landscape. It was just different. It was just, everything was just different back then. So it was just more competitive. You can't do that show if you do my show because there's only four places and I can't let people. Now that choices are infinite, it just doesn't even fucking matter. Like, yeah, I know that guy was on that show, but now he's on my show. So you like him, right? You know? So it's just everything's just different now. So I think they were all – that's probably just a reaction to all of that previous mentality.
Yeah, now it's just like we're all going to have less people. Is everyone okay with that?
We agree that it's a lot less.
It's a lot less people, but we all get some.
If you add up all of the audiences from every late night show, if you add all of them up, and there's a lot of them now, it is still dramatically less than what Carson was pulling in every night alone. Dramatically less. I mean, by like half, I think. So it's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting.
That, by the way, like just as a writer, like late night stuff is, to me, that's the best boot camp for just having to generate new material every day. Like there's no, I like writing on sitcoms and stuff too, but if someone had not been making me, if you had told me as a stand up, get up every morning and write 5 pages of your own jokes, I'd be like, I can't do it. There's no way. But it's like, get up every morning and write 5 pages of jokes about this. You're like, oh, okay. And like, once you think you can do that and know you can do that, it's pretty interesting. Like how that helps in other areas too, I guess.
Well, yeah, because it seems, it is hard, but I think it seems scarier than it actually is once you get past all of the, I don't know, like once you get past all the bad self-talk,
right?
Then it's like, oh yeah, I have a brain and I'm a person and I have experience doing this and I could, you know, they're not all going to be great jokes, but I could still write, you know, I could write them and some of them are going to be good, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it all goes back to stand-up. You're like, you've already experienced bombing. You've bombed, like people have literally, you know, not liked you to your face. Like, so what's the harm in like turning in a few crappy jokes on a page if a few of them are good?
Yeah.
You've already been told you suck in the worst possible way.
Yeah, bombing's really great for that reason, is that if you can survive it, you know, it is sort of like the walk on coals sort of a thing. Like, oh, all right, that stung, but I'm okay. I lived. Yeah. I want to do this again. I want to figure out. It's not the worst thing in the world. It feels bad, but you know, it's, you know, I'll feel okay tomorrow. It's not the worst thing in the world. But it's still you can, comfort really is kind of the enemy a lot of the time, especially if you're, you know, for me, I just started to get used to performing for people who came to see me on purpose. So if I drop into a room and none of those people know who I am, it reminds me like, oh, you got to stay on your toes. Like,
yeah.
These people don't know you, so you're not going to say, hey, it's me. And they're going to go, yes. You know, like you have to earn it again. And that's different.
Yeah. I still don't get that. Like once in a while, I'll hear like a mumbling of like, blah, blah, I saw her on Chelsea Lately. Like I'll get like, well, I'll like hear someone say that as I go on stage, but I don't really get like the big crowds like coming out just free, which I kind of like too.
Well, I think with the you know, like when you put the special, where is the special on
Netflix?
It's on Netflix.
And then iTunes, the album.
I think that's going to be tremendously helpful because Netflix will, you know, it'll pop up. It'll get recommended to people. Like Netflix is, one of the few really great platforms, because it does put it, it takes a lot of the searching out for, we still have to search through Netflix, but it has a thing set up where if someone goes to look at comedy, for now, your special is going to be one of the first things that pops up.
Yeah.
So that's tremendously helpful.
No, it is. It's great. I'm happy that it wound up there, especially because, like I said, when we made it, it was like, you know, I just wanted to do it with friends out of pocket, like not deal with what the end result was going to be. So like Netflix is a good end result for me, I think.
Do you think you'd be a good famous person?
No. I think I have too many, anxieties, like social anxieties already with people. Like I'm already like socially anxious when nobody knows who I am. I can't imagine I've been around like famous people when they're getting yelled at, and
it was like,
and then I get like anxious from people getting yelled at. Like, it just doesn't seem, I don't know. It doesn't seem that fun to me to be, if it's your fans and your audience and people who know exactly what you do, I get it. But to just be that guy from that thing to someone, that's when it sounds like scary and weird and a huge imposition. Like when you're just like, hey, it's that guy.
If you're walking into this grocery store and someone's like, are you sure my finger's in your butt? And you're like, I don't know you. What are you doing? Please.
Yeah, you get like a lot of those reactions to people of like, really liked you, would eat a cheeseburger for you. You know, some like reference to a joke that you...
Well, like the Saget's example was after Half-Baked, you know, like he'd be out with his kids and people would be like, hey, Bob Saget, you suck dick for Coke. And he's like, my kids are right here. Because I think, you know, you're sort of this kind of one-dimensional thing. I mean, they see you in two dimensions, right? They see you as a flat thing. So, you know, that's just how they relate to you.
Yeah.
I mean, it really doesn't, you know, if I'm somewhere and people are like, Talking Dead, Singled Out, Podcast, Points, or whatever they say, it doesn't really ever...
That's a guy who knows so much about you and yet so little. Like, doesn't know your name.
Yeah.
Doesn't know your name. Doesn't say, hi, Chris. They just like are like, I know him from... What do I know him from? And list every single thing you've done.
Auburndale Elementary School, Memphis, Tennessee. Whoa, what? Yeah, That's right. That would kind of freak me out is when people know intimate things and you're like, how do you know that? You know, but it's not really. I mean, again, none of this is ever a problem for me. I'm totally cool with it. You know, but I think there will be a day at some point where I'm in a really like bad mood or something horrible, and then someone's like, hey, Paul, you know, I'm like, please. I'm trying to heal from this thing. Why don't you understand? I'm a, you know, I can sort of, I can't picture myself ever having a meltdown, but I guess I can sort of understand why some people at the top levels will just like freak out at photographers or freak out at people. It's just like, please just give me a fucking space.
Yeah, it seems it seems like a lot of people just become very private. I mean, I know people who, you know, the minute they became huge, like I didn't see them anywhere again. Socially, or you know, people tend to hide out.
I think the best comparison I have for that is, you know, like you have a dog, right? You got a dog?
No.
You have a cat?
I have a dog that's on my Instagram all the time because I babysit it.
Oh, so that's not actually
dog. No, so people think it's my dog.
I follow you on the Instagram. You have a great view from your place.
Thank you.
You have a really nice apartment.
Thanks a lot.
But
it's one bedroom. It's not a big deal.
And it's pretty sweet, though. You can see the city from there. But the comparison that I have is, you know, coming home from work at the end of a day and having a dog, or like in this case, Chloe's dog, and... He's just really excited to see it. Like, oh my God, that's me. But if I'm just not in the mood, it's just like, please, just give me a minute. You know, like even with a dog who just wants a little bit of love, you know, let's have some boundaries. I just, give me a minute to decompress.
So you're saying fans are like dogs.
Oh man. See, I knew you were going to say it that way. And yes, yes, I do. They're just like Chloe's dog, Diego. But it, uh, it, it, it is kind of a it's an interesting thing that this idea that people, I don't know why, I guess because it makes us feel superior, this obsession that our culture has with fame, mm-hmm. and like being famous and having people, I don't know, I think it's nice, you know, when it's pleasant.
Yeah.
But it just, the dark sides of it seem so fucking...
So dark.
So weird and dark and devastating. And, you know, like if you do, you know, go and just shave your head in public, then everyone's like, oh, and then you freak out because everyone's poking at you and do something else. Like, yeah. Oh my God, how can this happen? And I'm like, oh, because they're being poked at by, yeah. a million different directions. I mean, it's not... Is it any shock that Justin Bieber keeps doing crazier and crazier shit? And the more it's like, look at this thing. It's just going to get worse.
Yeah. And I think as a comedian, obviously, like, you have to, if you want to keep doing stand up, you have to stay somewhat in the real world. And that's so hard to do if you're some big superstar.
Not only that, but, you know, ironically, a lot of comedians are not great at interpersonal communication. So, you know, like, seeing a person that, I mean, even like in Louis's case, you know, Louis's the most, one of the most flawless people on stage you could see. But if you see him in public and you run up to him, he can be awkward.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, you're not the fucking, you know, that's not, I thought you're supposed to be. And that can be kind of jarring for people, you know, if they don't kind of get what they want out of the experience. Or like, you know, the time I ran up to Steve Martin and found out that he actually doesn't love it when people run up and slobber all over him because he's very shy and socially anxious, you know, that we can have that sort of duality of our identity of like, oh, but you're on stage, you know, so it's hard to understand, like, but yeah. you're just on stage. Just talking to a bunch of people. Now I've cornered you.
That's not me. That's not the real me.
And then that's when you throw the smoke bomb down and disappear.
Yes.
So the special's on Netflix right now,
mm-hmm.
and forever, and iTunes. And you feel good about it? You feel like you got what you wanted out of it?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I feel like I kind of had like some freedom to do what I wanted, I guess. I mean, I do feel good about it.
Good.
I don't know why I'm being weird about that.
It's funny. You know why? Because it feels weird to admit it.
Yeah. It feels weird to say you like your own thing.
It's, you know, there's a sort of fine line between, and I think a lot of us have it, of the sort of self-deprecating thing or the not being comfortable with, you know, that things can be okay or we can be proud of things,
sure.
because it sort of exposes us in a weird sort of way to have to stand behind the things we do.
Yes.
Because, you know, if later you're like, you hate it, then it's like, oh, I got past that. I thought that was great at the time, but I got past it. You know, it just, sometimes it's hard to commit because it makes us more accountable of the things we do. And that's very uncomfortable to be accountable for everything that you do and say.
I was terrified to put it out, and I'll always be terrified to put things out. And, and I mean, even like this podcast where I'm just like, why am I doing, no one wants to hear me. Like in my head, like that's the inner voice. It's like, no one wants to see it. No one wants to hear it. And then
I wonder what that voice is. I mean, I wonder, everyone had that come from somewhere. I feel like mine was being sort of like unpopular in school or being popular for being unpopular, if that makes any sense. I wonder if that's where, I don't know. Where do you think yours came from?
I don't know. My confidence comes from like seeing things, you know, seeing myself rewarded for certain things, but not from myself.
Right.
It's all like outside factors. I'm like, oh, I must have done good because that person said I did good.
Yeah. Again, it's very.
To say something's good in my head, like, yeah, do I like it? Is it good? I put it out there. Yeah, I do like it, and I think you'll like it. Like that's what I want to say to people, but it sounds like wherever it starts in my head, I'm like, don't tell people they'll like it. Don't be an asshole.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is too. Is that, you know, I have this horrible fear of being the guy who's just not aware of himself,
right?
Where, you know, where you've seen people and it's not even that you can't put someone down for being hopeful. But if they just seem completely blind to the way a situation is about themselves, And I was like, that guy thinks he's killing and he's not killing, but he has no, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But when someone just doesn't want to acknowledge that, like, oh, it might be their fault for not, you know, I got a fucking audience.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I don't want to be the guy that thinks he's better than he actually is.
Yeah. So God forbid you be the guy who says that something's good and, you know. And have people go, oh, you hear Morgan on that podcast, she said she thinks her special's good. Like, I don't
know. Well, it gives people, you expose yourself to getting smacked. Like, it's basically like it is. It's making yourself vulnerable, like going, here, I'm just gonna open up my shirt and expose my heart.
Yeah.
So this gives you the opportunity to kick it with your shoe if you want to. And so, it's fear. I think it's just fear of being hurt, fear of being exposed. And I did Greg Fitzsimmons' podcast today, and it feels like he had the same sort of thing. I think a lot of comics, as much as we expose ourselves on stage, I think a lot of us actually have a really deep fear of being exposed in a weird sort of way. Like I was saying, because all the curtains are drawn in my dressing room, and he's like, oh, you don't like the sunlight? I'm like, yeah, I just don't like it that people could walk by and see me. Even like, not that I'm doing anything weird, I just don't like that I could be watched when I don't know. I just don't like feeling exposed, you know.
Sounds like a lot. Sounds like a lot to get into.
You think so?
I don't know. I mean, maybe you just don't. It's just you just want a little privacy. Maybe it's simple.
I wonder how many things are actually that simple. But it's like, no, man. This this time, my stepdad didn't pick me up on time, and I sat there when I was 13 and my brain was forming, you know. Or if it's just like, oh yeah, it's just uncomfortable if people.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a little weird. I get it.
Are you that way?
Do I want people looking at me while I'm working, you mean?
No, are you weird about, like, there's a girl near my girlfriend's apartment. There's this girl who lives in another apartment, and her drapes are always open. So if you're walking by, it's not even like, you don't even have to try to look in. You just see her living her life, sitting on the computer, her computer.
Yeah.
If I really stood there and stared, I could see exactly what it was that she was looking at. Windows in the kitchen, like, I can just watch her just sitting in her pajamas. And to me, that feels weird. I get uncomfortable for her, even though she doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I'm not, I feel like you want me to dive in and be just as anti people looking at you in the window as
well. Not
are.
If you don't feel that way.
I would be very uncomfortable with anybody. I'm very not that I need to be protective of my privacy now that people are trying to invade it, but I'm very I love my personal space, my private space, and my alone time. And
have you ever lived with a guy before?
No, like, I've never had I never had any siblings, and I had a couple of roommates, but I've never like lived with a guy or even, I mean, for most of my life I've lived by myself or with a parent.
Do you think if you do find that one really special person, that you're gonna be, do you think you're just gonna be like, you have your place and I'll have my place? Or
I think that's how it'll be for a long while. I don't see myself moving in with somebody and like giving up something that's that important to me, which is my own space. I can't. I don't know. I think about it a lot. I'm like, in my morning routine, I'm like, maybe I do all this wrong and no one knows it because they haven't seen it yet. Like, I always I don't know. I've never had somebody in my space that much. And I think part of the obstacle of like meeting someone even is letting somebody in a little bit. And I'm just like, I don't know if I'm ready to do that on so many fronts, like in my space, in my life. I'm like, I have a routine. It all works seemingly well, I think.
Oh, routines are great.
Yeah. That being said, I should desperately meet somebody.
You can't stay with me, though.
Oh, no. Wait, did you say you can't stay with me?
I was being you.
Oh, yeah.
You can't stay with me, though. Sorry. I would like to meet you and take you in doses. And now it is time for you to leave.
Yeah. But there are guys like that, too. So hopefully you meet someone who's got their own life and you have your own life and you can somehow figure out how those two blend without, you know, I don't know if I'll ever be the girl who wants to be with someone 100% of the time. And
maybe not. You know. Or maybe, you know, like maybe you'll meet someone and then it'll just be like, oh, this feels easy.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
And I'll leave everything for him.
Yay.
All my dreams and hopes.
So you're describing the plot of Bewitched, a show about rampant sexism. I want you to deny who you are, Sam, for me to live in my world.
I could weirdly see myself doing that, which is like if I met a guy and he lived in like Michigan and he made boats or something.
Not using your witchcraft?
Not using my witchcraft. I would not use my witchcraft. And I would, you know, I don't know, in a few years, go out and live in Michigan, make some boats.
Kind of sounds nice.
You want to come?
Yeah, I want to come make boats with you. We'll make comedy boats. Boats shaped like dicks. It'll be great.
Just penis canoes.
Penis canoes. Kayak. Cock. I don't know. I was trying to do something there that just didn't want to happen. So square peg, round hole. And no pun intended. We're kind of at the end of the podcast now. It flew by.
I'm supposed to end with like a big funny story?
No, this isn't a comedy set. You don't have to. You can if you want to. Do you have a big funny story?
I don't.
All right. Did you ever figure out when someone's finger was in your butt?
I think it was in my butt. I'm pretty sure it was in my butt. But since then,
did you sort of figure out the difference?
Yeah, I haven't had a lot of fingers in my butt since then. That was like a... I don't know. Should I have more in my butt?
I don't know. Listen, you just, you know, eventually you'll meet a guy that you want to move into your apartment in your butt. And until that time, there's no rush, you know, enjoy. Enjoy the personal butt space that you have.
Oh, it's so nice. It's so nice when your butt is your butt and nobody else's.
Nobody else's. I'm not ready to give my butt up yet.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to give my butt up to another person.
Soon.
But not yet. Get away from my butt, dog. I just got home. all right. That's it.
Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thanks for being here, Morgan Murphy. It's good to see you. And I know it's unfortunate because I really wanted you to do it at midnight, but your schedule just doesn't allow it.
Unfortunately. I will. I would love to do it, and I love the show.
Cool. Well, it's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. You should tell everyone, enjoy your burrito. You have a good voice.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
It's so pleasant. All right. The end. Spike in the microphone. Oh, I don't want to break the new microphone. I'm sorry. Poor Katie. No. I just got those.
Was that okay?
No. We're going to have to do that all over.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.